I thought I might be when you said how different the book was going to be. It was entertaining, but it was also informative. But you said there have been a lot of other books out there about you.
Sure, there's bunches of them.
What was this sort of a...
The revenge?
I want to say revenge. Let's get the records a bit straighter.
No, well, you can't straighten out the record because, you know, who? First of all, who cares? Secondly, there's just so much stuff out there, and some of it is so preposterous. You just spend the rest of your life trying to unwrinkle it, and I don't need that.
Yeah.
I wrote the book because of the stuff in the back of the book where I got a chance to write the little essays on the different topics. That was my main reason for doing the book.
You also apologize for those that maybe you left out, and maybe even some of those that you put in as well, which that's got to be hard though when you're writing a book, and because people are bound to say, well, you know,
why wasn't I in there? Yeah, well, I'm sure there will be some who will say that, but you know, did the best I could with the time and space allotted to me. There were restrictions on how long the book could be, versus how large the type was, versus the cost of the paper, versus how many cartoons went in there, you know, all these special publishing considerations that I don't know anything about, but they figured it out, and, you know, there it is. The book, it's done, it's out of my face, and as soon as I finish this book signing that I have to do tomorrow in the Valley, I've given them the 1 week out of my life in the United States to promote it, and there it goes. I don't have to relive this experience until September when the book comes out in England.
Oh, and then paperback, maybe?
Well, I don't know, you know. That's down the road.
What was this a bit of a trial doing the book? Because I mean, you're involved in so much other stuff as well.
Well, it was a little rough because when we first started doing the interviews for the book, we were preparing the rehearsals for the 1988 tour. So in January of '88, while we were rehearsing 8 hours a day, I would end the rehearsal at midnight and then begin interviews in this room from 1 a.m. until 6 a.m. Mm-hmm. 6 days a week for 3 weeks. And then those tapes were then transcribed. I went off and did a tour. When I got back, I was handed an enormous pile of paper, which purported to be the book. And Peter Occhio Grosso had taken the way that I talk and made it look like a normal person, and it looked just like a book. And I was going, nobody who knows me will ever believe that this thing is real. So I had the choice. I could have taken the easy way out and said, okay, get it out of here. But instead, I said, well, I got nothing to do for the next 3 months after the tour was over, and I went into the little office upstairs and literally wrote the book. So, Peter did all the hard work. He organized the material, you know, got the chapters in order and the rest of that stuff, but I just broke it all back down and wrote it the way I talk.
Did you think that you might either end up with a book that might have... I mean, some people say, well, I'll never be able to make a book. I'll probably only maybe write half a dozen pages. And other people, they sit down and they remember things and say, my God, this is going to be like the Encyclopedia Britannica. It's going to be...
Well, it could have been, but I mean, I'm a businessman, and I was told right from the start, how big, how many pages, approximately how many words, and there's not going to be any more, and it shouldn't be any less than this, and that's your target, so shoot for it. And that's what I did.
How easy was it to come up with the theme?
The theme?
Or the themes, I should say.
Pretty easy. I mean, there's certain things that I appear to have fixations on, like televangelists and politics and stuff like that. That was easy.
Yeah.
Since it's kind of inescapable in the United States, or at least it was during that season.
Yes, yes. Also, of course, music comes into it a bit, and there's...
Well, there's a good reason for that. You see, you understand, I am a composer and a musician and everything. I thought I'd just dribble a dab of that in there.
How about EMS 401?
Well, you see right over there on the wall is the original letter that Varese wrote to me. I still got it framed and sitting right over there. EMS 401 is the record number of an album called The Complete Works of Edgar Varese, Volume 1.
What was it that pulled you into that, enthralled you?
Well, I'll skip the part about how I found out about the album, but as soon as I heard it, I just liked the music. It was something that I enjoyed. I didn't have a musical education. It was not an intellectual process where somebody told me this is avant-garde, so you should like it. I just listened to it and liked it, and that's the way it was. Same way with rhythm and blues. Same thing.
You had a lot of moving around as well, that we gather from the book. I mean, people might have read before that, you know, you move from here and move to there and maybe think it was like 2 or 3 times, but it seems like it was 203 times.
Yeah, I moved around a lot when I was a kid, and one thing that is really good for my kids right now is, with the exception of Moon, who was born in New York, and then when we moved back to California, we lived in the log cabin for a while and then moved into this house. All the other kids have been in one house all the rest of their lives. And that's, I think that's good for a family.
Has that been coincidental, or was that very deliberate that you wanted to do that?
Well, I don't like to move. I mean, anybody who likes to move, I mean, you got to be crazy. Sticking things in boxes and carrying them up and down steps, what kind of a person goes for that? So I was happy that we decided to buy this house and move in here, and we've just been sitting here ever since.
Right. Where, it doesn't come out fully in the book, but when was it that you felt that you wanted to be a performer of music rather than, if you're like, a listener and appreciator?
When I was about 15.
And that's when you went and hit the drums.
Yeah, I really like drums. Well, I started playing drums in the school orchestra when I was 12, but I got this urge to rock right around 15. You know how it is when you get the urge to rock. You've got to rock.
Even if it is saucepans.
Yeah, well, I didn't own a drum set, so I wanted to be the drummer in this rhythm and blues band called the Ramblers. And they had a gig at this place called the Uptown Hall at 40th and Meade in San Diego. I don't even know whether this place is still there, but there was a girls' gang, her club, and it was the Blue Velvets that had decided to rent the hall and throw a dance, and they hired this band, and this was going to be the first performance that this band would give, and the name of the band was Ramblers. And the leader of the band was a guy named Elwood Jr. Medeo, who was also known at school as Bamba the Jungle Boy. He was part Sicilian and part Indian. And I must say that the cuisine at Mr. Medeo's house was very, very interesting. It was the first place that I had ever discovered that wonderful dish, the burrito. And if you can imagine a burrito as manufactured by a mother from India, this truly is an experience. So I wanted to play the drums in this band, and I didn't have any drums, and they were very, very tolerant, and they let me practice by sticking a couple of pots between my legs and beating on them with drumsticks. And I could keep a pretty good beat that way. The only thing is, if you're rehearsing for a dance job, and all you're rehearsing on is two pots between your legs like bongos, you forget that you have to do stuff with your feet. It never occurred to me that I had to learn how to coordinate the thing that you do with your right foot with the bass drum going boom, 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 that helps people remember how to dance. So there was a double disaster on opening night of the Ramblers. On the way to the gig, I forgot my drumsticks, the only pair that I had. And in those days, you know, you really had to scrimp to get gas money to drive to the other part of town. So I think it was Junior who was suffering the most here because, he had to squander vast amounts of gas money in order to double back so I could get my cheesy drumsticks. So we get there, set it up, dance is a little bit late, we start rocking, so to speak, and here I now have a drum set which costs $50, and I am confronted with this device called the bass drum pedal. I barely knew how to attach this thing to the bass drum, and now I must use my foot on it and work my hands at the same time and accommodate the whims of people who wish to dance. This was not really a terrific sounding band on opening night, I will assure you. So I was eventually fired from the Ramblers for playing the cymbals too much.
Actually, I'm surprised that you had legs to play between, because you got involved in science a bit earlier.
Oh yeah, well, I used to like explosives long, long, long time ago, and I used to, a lot of kids like to build little bombs and stuff, and one day I was building a bomb in my garage, and I was loading it. I was sitting on the floor of a dirt-floored garage in Pacific Grove, California, and I had this cardboard tube, which was an expended tube from some other kind of fireworks that I had found, and I was loading it with gunpowder, pieces of one-shot caps with the paper trimmed off, ground up match heads, ground up ping pong balls, anything else that I could find that was combustible, and I was putting this in layer after layer and smashing it down into the tube with a drumstick. And I guess one of the smashing down strokes was a little bit too fervent, and the thing blew up, nearly ripping my testicles off. So obviously they did not come off, because I have four children, let that be a lesson to you. So shortly thereafter my scientific career came to an end, and I moved directly to rocking.
Yes. You would have been rolling if you hadn't done that.
Well, when the thing went off, I was rolling because it made a crater in the floor and it blew me back. It blew the garage doors open and just knocked me right back on my back. Now, that's as close as I ever want to come to having a mule kick me in the groin. That was not a really good experience.
I don't know why I'm laughing, because I shouldn't, but I suppose.
No, you shouldn't laugh at stuff like that. You should experience it for yourself and then try and explain it to somebody else, or maybe even write a couple of paragraphs about it in the book.
Or kick them and say something like that.
Yeah, it's kind of like that. And say boom while you're doing it.
Yes. Well, at least you got to that gig and were able to play. Well, we'll use the term roughly play, but there was one night when you were not allowed to go to a gig. You were pulled over by the boys in blue.
Well, I wasn't exactly pulled over. These guys decided that they would perform. Well, let's say, what was the term in those days? It was illegal entrapment. They proposed to entrap me into performing a crime. And that phone's going to keep ringing all the time through the interview. Don't worry about it. Once upon a time, I had a recording studio in Cucamonga, and I was starving to death in this place. I was very poor, okay? And I sure could use some money to get something to eat. One day, there's a knock on the door, and this man who comes in, introduces himself as a used car salesman, tells me that some of his friends are having a party next Wednesday, and could I make a movie for them? He wanted a porno movie. Now, why would he come to me? Because I had a sign on the front of my recording studio that said TV Pictures. Now, where did I get this sign? I got it at an auction. It was a nice-looking sign. I couldn't make TV Pictures in my place. It's a storefront in Cucamonga. So I hung up this nice-looking sign, red lacquer, gold letters. It only cost $2. And here comes this guy looking for a porno movie to entertain used car salesmen. Now, suppose somebody offered you this opportunity. Wouldn't you want to keep a guy like that happy? I certainly did. So anyway, I told him, because I, you know, wanted to be helpful, I said, in order for me to prepare this type of exotic entertainment for you and your friends, it would be very difficult, especially to make a movie by next Wednesday. I suggested that they could have just as much frolic and gratification if I made them an audio tape. So at this point, this guy, whose real name was Detective Willis, gives me a list of sexual activities that he desired to have represented in the tape. And I said, fine, this is going to be no problem. And he leaves. We made a deal. He was going to give me $100 for this tape, and he was going to pick it up the next day. And I'm thinking to myself, $100? Do you know how much peanut butter that'll buy? So that evening, I made this recording with this girl. There was no sex involved in it. It was just, you know, mumbo-jumbo, squeaking some bed springs, and, you know, just all this artificial sex noise. And then I edited the thing down to take all the laughs out. I stayed up all night to take all the laughing out, so it sounded almost like real dramatized sex. Put some music behind it, totally produced it. He had a really nice tape. Next day he shows up, and he wants to give me $50 for the tape. I said, well, look, the deal was $100. That's it. Goodbye. The tape never changed hands. He never bought anything from me. That was it. Well, instead of leaving, flash bulbs went off, people ran in, handcuffs all over the place. This guy had been broadcasting all of my conversations through a wrist radio to somebody recording something in a truck outside the place. It was just like Dick Tracy. And I got arrested for conspiracy to commit pornography. And to make a long story short, the way the thing was settled, I had to plead nolo contendere, which means I don't have enough money to get justice in America. And means, you know, I'm not guilty, I'm not guilty, I just say, you know, I got no more money, I can't fight it, what are you going to do with me? Net result, they made me spend 10 days in the San Bernardino County Jail plus the sentence was 6 months with all but 10 days suspended. So I had to serve 10 days. And then 3 years probation. And if I violated the terms of the probation, I would have to go back and do the rest of the 6 months. And anyway, that's Cucamonga. That complicated enough for you?
Wasn't there another time you were going to go to a gig and they picked you up on a trumped-up vagrancy?
Oh, that was when I was in high school. I wanted to do this little rock and roll dance in Lancaster. And I got arrested at 6 o'clock in the evening walking down the main street in Lancaster, California for vagrancy because the police department wanted to keep any hint of rock and roll out of the Antelope Valley.
God, some of these guys.
Oh, they're wonderful. You know, in Lancaster, you could be arrested for spitting while walking. They got nothing else to do. Come on, it's a desert.
Yes. Devoid of a lot of things, yeah. Including the brain power.
Excuse me, I'm going to rumble this microphone for a minute. Whoops.
Of course, not unexpectedly, the Captain B appears now and again in the book, but I was rather intrigued. You suggested that maybe you knew him more before you guys were... Or you were with
I spent more time with him, you know, when we were in high school than after he went into show business, you know. Because at the point where Captain Beefheart went into show business, he also kind of went into another mindset, like another zone, almost another dimension, mm-hmm. which enabled him to say and do and be all the things that he appears to be on the albums that he has made. But in high school, it was a different story. Everybody called him Vleet, and he dropped out of school because his father had a heart attack, and he took over his father's bread truck route. And I used to go over to his house, and we'd listen to rhythm and blues records and eat whatever was left over from the bread truck. They had, like, pineapple buns and things that people in Mojave wouldn't buy. And we'd stay up all night and listen to Jimmy Reed records and Howlin' Wolf records, eat the pineapple buns, and then occasionally drive over to the Denny's and get a cup of coffee. That's what you do in a town with no teenage entertainment. Starch, records, and coffee.
How about girls? Were there any?
Where, in Lancaster? Sure, they had girls there. You know, I think that most of them were fairly well, entranced by the varsity and, you know, those kinds of people. One thing about listening to rhythm and blues records, you know, there's not too many girls that like that kind of music, and if that's your life, it's hard to have anybody who is female in the vicinity because there weren't too many girls that wanted to hear the Howlin' Wolf. Let's face it. It wasn't girl-type stuff.
I was going to say, going through the book, I was like, you've got to be the first guy I've either ever interviewed or ever read about who didn't get into rock and roll because they wanted girls around. You know, it looked like there were no girls who were going to be interested, like you say. There were going to be no girls interested in the type of music that you wanted.
Well, the first clue that I ever had that there was a relationship between playing music and girls in abundance was a comment that was made by Elwood Jr. Medeo on the front lawn of Mission Bay High School circa 1955. And what he said was, girls, this is musician's pleasure. You know, since I wasn't a rock and roll musician at that time, one could only speculate on what this meant. Who could know what the 60s would bring about?
Right. You mentioned that you had wonderful sign outside your moving picture company.
Mm-hmm.
You bought what, Power Records as well. Seems to have an entrepreneurial leaning there in those early days.
Well, I've always said I was a businessman, even when it was unfashionable to do so. Because I believe that artists who say, I'm just an artist and, you know, please don't trouble me with these mundane things, they usually wind up either broke or worse. You know, you can die from that stuff. You have to look out for your own business interests. And an ideal world for an artist would be one in which he can earn a living from doing what he knows best how to do, his art. Now, who's going to help you do that? Artists have no friends. You know, where are you going to find somebody to really, really take care of your business for you? They don't exist. All they do is stick their hand in your pocket. And if they don't take your money, they're going to be reaching for your private parts, or both.
So, squeeze.
That's right. Squeeze, and then you dance. Dance till you die. So I prefer to be involved in the business proceedings and try and make the act of doing business part of a creative act and, you know, involve it in the overall concept of what I do, which has led to some rather amusing album covers, I think, and some pretty bizarre advertising campaigns for the products.
Yeah.
I try and, you know, if you have to advertise, make it interesting. If you have to do an album cover, make it interesting. If you have to do an interview, make it interesting.
And if you're going to make a record, even make that interesting as well.
That's right. Yeah. Sure, you should always make it interesting. But if you want to keep making it interesting in a world that doesn't want interesting stuff, you have to keep fighting to merchandise it.
Have there been times when you've almost thought, why am I doing this? Why should I bother let me just go off and be a businessman and not a performer.
Yeah, about 2 or 3 weeks ago.
Yeah?
Yeah.
And?
Then I went in there and started typing on the synclavier, and I felt a lot better.
That happens quite frequently, or just...
No, it's just that it's been getting to the point where I know that as I approach 50 years old, that it is more and more ludicrous to think of me on a stage with a guitar around my neck singing Dynamo Hum. Give me a break. Okay? And also, I have many other interests besides doing that kind of stuff. So I would like to just, you know, do many things. And I will continue to move in that direction, the direction of many things.
You say now, you know, heading for 5-0 and not, don't want to do it. Did you envision yourself at even... if when you got to 30 or 40 that you would not be doing that?
Well, that's the kind of thing that people would expect from anybody in basically what is a young man's business. You know, you have to be fairly spry to get that and get out there and even survive a rock and roll tour. And, you know, I don't exercise, I don't jog, I don't diet, I don't do anything. I just go out there and do it. And since I don't have much time or energy invested in personal maintenance, you know, approaching 5-0 is a serious condition for a guy like me. My eyesight is getting worse. I get back pains. I don't like to stand up so much. I can't stand walking around airports. I don't like to travel. I'm lazy. I'm lethargic, you know. And this is, rock and roll has turned into this athletic competition. I like to play music, but the rest of the stuff is totally irrelevant to me.
Who wants to tour?
Yeah, I mean, I like to play guitar sitting down. Who wants to do that? You know, who would pay a ticket? Who would buy a ticket to see a guy playing a guitar sitting down? What, you're not playing it with your teeth? You're not jumping through midair? You can't be any good. Get out of here.
Well, you could probably initiate the first video tour of the U.S. You could stay at home, do a concert, and have it satellited.
Yeah, you probably could, but, you know, who's even going to watch that? They don't even know I exist anymore. I don't get the records on the radio, except in Europe occasionally. I got a fax about a week ago saying that I have a record in the top 10 in Switzerland, you know. Okay, this is a surprise. It's very nice, but, you know, the same record, which is absolutely suitable for people in Switzerland, would never get played in the air in the United States.
What is that record?
Elvis has just left the building.
The Broad from Broadway.
Yeah.
That is I love that album.
The CD is even better than the album.
That's
there's 9 or 10 more cuts on
yeah.
it.
Yeah, yeah. And Sting coming on, is it?
Yeah, wasn't that a surprise?
And especially hearing him mouth that word, which probably would shock a few people, surprise a few people. Why
well,
not?
Yeah, sure. I mean, he used to be a school teacher. He can talk like that.
He probably had a lot of kids talk back to him like
mm-hmm.
that. How did you get him, by the way?
He came to the concert, and during the intermission, I brought him backstage, and I said, well, now that you've seen what we do, because I don't think he'd ever seen our show, I said, how'd you like to come on stage with us? And he said, yeah, sure. So I told him we were going to do this song, Stolen Moments, and then after the trumpet solo, we could do a vamp, and he could come out and sing whenever he wanted. And he got a yellow pad, and he started writing down words on it. I thought he was going to create this completely unique new song, but obviously he thought better of it and did Murder by Numbers. And I thought it worked out real well. There was no rehearsal involved.
Yeah, that was sweet.
For those of you who hear that one strange little noise after he is introduced, like the band goes, something like that, that's a sound effect that was inserted to accompany the fact that it was a winter gig. And here he is, comes on stage in an overcoat, and he wanted to take his coat off, so I'm helping him with his coat, and the coat comes off, and underneath he's got all the muscles and a little shirt, and, you know, and the crowd went wild. So we gave it some sound effects in there.
Do you have that on film or on tape?
No, just the recording.
Now, that's something else that you, or I say almost pioneered. You used to have your performances shot, didn't you?
Well, on the 1982 tour, we had a unique individual named Thomas Nordig working on the road crew, and he was, let's call him video obsessive type guy. And he had a little Hitachi VHS camera. And after he did all of his roadie stuff, he would every night videotape every show. So I've got a whole wall of those things over there just from 1982. And occasionally we do like multi-camera shoots, professional multi-camera shoots. So there's a few concerts that were stored that way. But in audio, a huge number of concerts have been taped.
What do you do when you... Do you go back through those and sort of pick up on things and try and critique and change things?
No, what I do is I've been releasing in stages a project called You Can't Do That on Stage Anymore. And this is a set of six double CDs. And the premise is, what would it be like if you could take all the different bands that I've had for the last 25 years and have them all on stage at the same time, segueing from one band to another, one year to another, one size room to another, sometimes right in the middle of the song, just this fantasy concert type thing. So we're getting ready to release the third installment of that within the next couple of months. And interesting project.
Yeah. We mentioned earlier about whether you ever thought you'd be doing it at 30 or 40, etc. That's one side of it. Looking back, does it seem as if you've been doing it that long?
Well, it doesn't feel like I've been doing it that long, except for the fact that, you know, as you get older, you can get all the usual aches and pains and stuff. But the time is just squashed into one little compressed wad when I'm working with tapes that span all those years. I mean, you know, it doesn't seem like it's been any time at all. But on the other hand, I'm sure there are people out there saying, please stop doing this. Just get out of there. Okay, enough. You've been doing it for too long. Stop. I don't want to hear it anymore. Go away. Give me a group that lip syncs. Give me models.
The ironic thing is that we learned from the book that in actual fact, you got the record deal based on one song, which wasn't truly representative of what you did anyway.
Well, you know, buyer beware. You know, the guy came in there and he heard one song, a boogie number. He thought he was signing a white blues band. And, he's entitled to make a few mistakes.
Right, okay. Yeah. But wasn't there also a time when you, was you playing a club called the Action Club?
Yep, it's not there anymore. It used to be on Santa Monica Boulevard, either Santa Monica or Melrose. It's down in Hollywood, it's a little place. And
a certain guy came in?
Oh. Yeah. Well, first let me tell you what kind of a club it was. The guy who owned it was an ex-prize fighter, you know, had a lot of friends who were Italian. He was sort of Italian himself. And the people who used to go there were, let's call them prostitutes. And people from show business, television show people, and sometimes actors and stuff. And we were working there one night on Halloween. I think it was 1965 or 66. I can't remember. And we had to play five sets a night. And the house was packed. There was a lot of celebrities in there and a lot of prostitutes. And I was sitting on the front porch just before the last set. And here comes John Wayne, some ladies in evening gowns, and a couple of bodyguards. And he comes over to me, and he picks me up, gives me a big hug, slaps me on the back, and he says, I saw you in Egypt, and you were great, and then you blew me. And I took an immediate dislike to this guy. So when it came time to do the last set, I went back up on stage, and I said, ladies and gentlemen, an important announcement. We were going to have George Lincoln Rockwell, head of the American Nazi Party, come here tonight. He couldn't make it. But instead, here's John Wayne. And I aimed the microphone, leaned the stand down, and he took the microphone, and he was drunk, and he reeled out onto the floor, and he started doing this little speech like, well, if I'm elected, and the audience just looked at him like, who is this chump? And it was John Wayne. So his bodyguards came over, grabbed me, grabbed the mic, made him sit down, pushed me back up onto the stage, pushed the mic back on the stage, and said, don't do any more of this, or there'll be big trouble. So after the gig was over, and I'm leaving, the owner, the man who was a ex-boxer who had Italian friends, comes over to me and says, hey, be nice to Duke. When he gets like this, he starts throwing $50 bills around. So I didn't care about Duke's $50 bills, and I start to walk out. Well, in those days, I used to wear this Homburg hat with the crown of it pushed up, kind of looked like an Indian hat or a gypsy hat or something like that. And as I'm walking by his table, he stands up and he takes his hand and he smashes the hat down on top of my head. So I took it off and popped out the crown again. And I said, I'm not even going to give you a chance to apologize. So he smashes it down again. He says, well, you don't like the way I fix hats? I've been fixing hats for 40 years, you know. I mean, I didn't like this man, you know. I mean, I used to like cowboy pictures, sort of. And he was kind of a heroic kind of a guy. But, you know, you stick a little alcohol in some of these guys, put them in a room full of prostitutes, and that's what happens.
God. Okay. I actually know Bill Harris quite well. I didn't know mm-hmm. that you had offered him bed and board for a while.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Famous critic, Bill Harris. That's right. He went to school with my brother, Robert, and Dick Barber, who eventually became our road manager and the guy who invented all the snorks on the records. And another guy named Bill Kieselhorst, too. I think they were all in New York at the same time when we were living there. And we had an apartment that was smaller than this room that we're in. And Gail and I, Cal Schenkel, and this bunch of guys all lived in this little box during the summer of 67.
So was Bill critiquing you even then?
No, actually, I have some film of him assisting in carrying the vegetables in for the Whirling and for the Money album cover.
Oh, I'm going to get in for that.
Yeah. He helped chop up the watermelons for that shoot.
Oh, lovely. Oh, I'm going to probably see him on the weekend. I'll get him back. One of the other things I had to smile at was that you were nearly thrown out of a band because you weren't conforming.
Okay. The early mothers liked chemical refreshment, and I didn't. And that was a constant source of conflict. And on one occasion, they thought that they had outgrown the need for a band leader, and there was this band meeting, and they kind of wanted to get rid of me because, you know, I wasn't one of the real guys. And one of the guys in the band suggested that I go to Big Sur and take acid with somebody who believed in God. Didn't work. I didn't go. I didn't take it. Never used LSD. And still, yet still, wound up staying in the band.
That seems to, just from the sort of attitude around that piece, seems to that to you that's a real source of annoyance that so many people seem to think that was sort of like one of your chief things, that you were really into that.
Well, it's because everybody was into it, you know, and they couldn't, since they were all into it, they couldn't believe that anybody wouldn't because they all liked it so much. But I watched them turn, you know, into vegetable-like objects over a period of time. Not just the guys in the band, but a lot of people. You know, a whole generation getting vegetated from using that stuff. So, why should I?
Right. You also bring up in the book, sort of touch on that as well, Hendrix and the visit to Charles Street.
Well, once upon a time, Jimi Hendrix came over to visit me when I lived at 7th Avenue and Charles Street. He was on his way to a party, and he came into the place with Buddy Miles. And Buddy came in, sat down on the couch. Jimmy said, Frank, this is Buddy. Buddy said hello. His head went back. His mouth got open. He started snoring as loud as he could, and he just stayed in that position for the entire time that he was in the house. Hendrix was demonstrating a new dance step for Gail's benefit, ripped his velvet pants, and Gail had to sew up the crotch of his pants so that he could go to a party. He went over, he woke up Buddy Miles, Buddy stopped snoring, they smiled, thanked me, and left.
Isn't that nice that Buddy Miles appreciates music, huh?
Well, I think, you know, I always thought he could have had one sensational hit if he would have sung I Am the Walrus. Because at that time he kind of looked the part, and it would have been fantastic.
Which, talking about a Beatles song, John Yoko came on stage when you were at the East. Yeah?
Yeah, we were playing the Fillmore East in 1971. We were doing this live recording, and a journalist from the Village Voice thought he would give me a big surprise, and we were there for two or three days at the Fillmore East, and I guess it was on the afternoon of the last gig. I was introduced to John, and...
And was that the first time you'd met him?
Yeah. And I invited him to come to the gig and play with us, and he said fine, he would be down there. And he did, came on stage with Yoko. We took turns conducting the band. We played Baby Please Don't Go, and this song called Scumbag that we made up on the spot. We also played King Kong. Now what they did... The agreement that we had was, since I was already recording, we had the recording truck there, I said, here's the deal. I'll give you a copy of the tape, you mix it the way you want, you put it out on your album. I'll keep a copy of the tape, I'll mix it the way I want, I'll put it out on my album. Okay, deal was done. Next thing I know, he's putting out on this Sometime in New York album a song entitled Jam Rag. Well, Jam Rag was actually King Kong. And usually when a person records a song, they give the author of the song and the publisher of the song credit and royalties. And what they had done is they had taken my song, King Kong, changed the name of it, and given themselves writer and publisher credit on the song.
How was it actually on the night working with them on stage? I mean, did you feel that...
Well, in those days, I mean, here you are in a place that was like party time. Place was packed. Half the audience full of Romil RCF cough medicine. And, you know, whoever, who knows what else. And it's an event. It's not just music. It's an event. So, you know, there's a lot of ugly notes and mistakes and randomness going on, but it was an event.
How did you sort of look at him as a musician? Or, I mean, yes, you're out there playing and you're worried about what you're going to do, but looking at him, did he seem as if there was a certain creativity there, or that there was a certain, obviously, formula?
Well, I have a feeling that there was quite a bit of nervousness going on. Some of this is borne out by the book that was written about him. But I saw him one more time after that. I went to dinner with him and Yoko about a week later, and that was the last time I saw him.
So, I mean, there wasn't sort of any preconceived idea about what you'd thought of him beforehand?
Well, you got to understand, I'm not a Beatles fan, never was. There was three songs that they did that I thought were really good songs, and I, you know, still enjoy hearing them.
Which are the three?
Well, I like Paperback Writer, I Am the Walrus, and Strawberry Fields. Those are my favorite ones.
What is it that appeals to you about those?
Interesting chords, I like the tunes, you know. It's not just interesting music.
Mm-hmm. A bit early, we sort of left off with Jimmy and Charles Street. Tom and Jerry, you came to a bit later on.
Oh, God. Well, what are you going to do, make me recite my book here?
There's just some interesting things that I just...
Once upon a time, I walked into Manny's music store, and I'm in there looking at guitars, and it's raining, and this little guy comes in, and he's all wet, and he says, "Hi, I'm Paul Simon. Will you please come to my house for dinner?" And I said, "Okay, fine." And I didn't know much about him or his music or anything, but, you know, free dinner. So I went, and to make a long story short, he was there with Art Garfunkel, and they were reminiscing about when they used to go on the road. And I don't know how long it had been since they'd actually done a live gig, but we were right in the middle of a tour, and the following night we were going to be playing someplace in upstate New York. So I said, "Well, you know, you really want to catch the road aroma one more time. Why don't you guys come out and be our opening act?" See, a long time ago, they used to be called Tom and Jerry, and they had this record called Schoolgirl, Hey Schoolgirl in the Second Row, which had this chorus that went, "Ooh, bapa, luchi, ba, she's mine." And I said, "Go out there and open for us as Tom and Jerry. You'll have a good time." So sure enough, the next day they got on the plane, went to upstate New York, went out there, opened the show. And the audience didn't know who they were. They had a nice time being Tom and Jerry, sang all their old songs. And after we played our set, I brought them back on and they played Sounds of Silence. Then the audience suddenly got the picture. "Whoa, hooray, hurrah. Now, oh yeah, big hit group. Oh." Whereas before, when they were just the opening act singing "Ooh, Bapa, Luchi, Ba, She's Mine," it's like, oh, two guys with acoustic guitar and short, white short-sleeve shirts on. And on the way out of the gig, this girl came up to me and said, "How could you do that? How could you do that to Simon and Garfunkel? Like, you know, like I'd punished them or done something weird." And we hadn't. We gave them an opportunity to have a good time.
But one thing that I think probably every musician in the world would love to have been a member of your band, but other people might look at it and say, "My God, is the guy crazy?" That whatever was happening, whether something was happening or not, you were paying your guys.
Well, in those days, we do a different system now, because when the tour is over, then everybody goes and gets whatever gig they can get. But in those days, they got paid every week, whether they worked or not. And anybody who wants to start a band, don't do that. It's too expensive. And it reduces the incentive to rehearse. You know, when you have that guaranteed paycheck and there's no edge, and you know, whether you're just going to get it rain or shine, there's no big urge to build on what you've accomplished and develop more stuff. I've had a very difficult time getting these guys to attend rehearsals, let alone pay attention once they got there. And so ultimately that band kind of auto-destructed.
What was the initial intention behind that? Was it to sort of try and keep some... once you found people that you liked, that you wanted to keep them together, was that...
Yeah, you have to keep them together.
And
I mean, Jimmy Carl Black was married. He had 5 kids. What are you going to do?
Yeah. We mentioned earlier about the plaque up on, or the music up on the wall and the different people that you've worked with. How have people taken you from... when you've approached them who were in different areas of music?
What do you mean?
Well, some people, when they move from like pop to classical, you might expect that the classical people might sort of raise their eyebrows at them and think, you know, what
well, people raise their eyebrows at me anyway, so what? I raise mine right back at them. Watch this. See that? You know, it's mutually, you know, we can do it to each other, sort of, with the eyebrows going up and down. But I started off writing... chamber music and orchestral pieces before I even wrote a rock and roll song. So when I went from rock and roll back to working with orchestras, it wasn't really anything too weird for me. But because in those days when people had long hair and truly ugly clothes on, you walk into a room full of guys wearing those...
Shut up.
You walk into a room full of guys wearing tuxedos and stuff, holding little brown things that they rub sticks on and, you know, shiny yellow things that go blat blat when they blow them, and they think they're ruling the world, so to speak. And you walk in with some music for them, and you look like a derelict, and they think they're so esteemed. Then, you know, the eyebrows do go up and down, but so what?
Just let it go, yeah?
Yeah.
Is that something that maybe you want to go back to, maybe working with a more classical orchestra?
No, it's too expensive. It's, I mean, having a rock and roll band is expensive enough, but dealing with orchestras is even more expensive. For example, the San Francisco Symphony, which is probably not the world's most renowned orchestra, their annual budget is something like $23 million just to keep that band together. So,
you mentioned the BBC Symphony a couple of times. Was that out of admiration or...
Well, I've used members of the BBC on stage. We did a concert at the Royal Festival Hall in 1968 and used 14 guys from the BBC, and they were fine. And when I was doing some work later with Pierre Boulez, he had spoken very kindly of the BBC, and in his opinion, at least at that time, said he thought it was the best orchestra that he had ever worked with. So I've never worked with a full BBC Symphony, but I would imagine that a recommendation from Pierre Boulez would be pretty hard to come by, since this guy, if you think I'm weird, this guy is Mr. Perfectionist.
You're a perfectionist? Do you consider yourself to be?
Listen, I'm a derelict compared to Pierre Boulez in terms of perfectionism. I'm a mere pup tent.
But so like you used to think you were until you met him?
Well, people would say I was. I mean, I just do my stuff the way I do it. Whether it's perfectionistic or not depends on, you know, what kind of a piece you're writing on me. I mean, I think that he truly does want to squeeze every last ounce of excellence that he can out of the people that he works with. And I'm pragmatic enough to know that in some instances there is no excellence to be squeezed from the people that I'm working with.
I don't know. You listen to the albums over the years. There sounds like there's been some good playing there.
Sure, but I mean, think of how many different bands there have been. And sometimes you can't always hire the guy you want to hire, and you have to take Mr. Number 2 or Mr. Number 3. So at that point, you know, you just have to say, well, it's not going to be the world's greatest musicological experience, but anyway, we can rock.
Yeah, and just take it from there. You've got a little emblem up there on the mantle there since I was last here that Naris decided to give out. Do you sort of look upon that as an honor or a joke?
It's a joke. It's a little plastic joke on a piece of wood. I mean, figure it out. I got a Grammy for a song called Jazz from Hell. Nobody in life ever heard this song, and I'm sure nobody in NARIS, the organization that hands out the Grammys, I'm sure none of the people who voted to make this the best song, instrumental song of 1988, I'm sure they never even heard this thing. I can't conceive of any of those people listening to that song, and even if they did listen to it, imagine them liking it. It's ridiculous. So why is that thing over there? I don't know. But it's an ugly reminder of just how strange things can get when you get hooked on award shows.
If you would could sort of adopt any of your other cuts and say that should have been one that got a Grammy, is there one that you felt should have got some recognition?
Oh, I'm sure there's something, but I mean, I don't even think about them once they're done.
Yeah. If that's the way of Grammy shows, how about talk shows? You had a bit, you had a venture out with a late show.
Yeah, I tried to get a show on ABC Network. I wanted to do a show called Night School. And there's a whole section in my book dedicated to the topic of failure. And in this section, it has examples of the actual proposals that were turned over to people for various projects that have failed. And one of them was this Night School television show. And I don't want to dwell on all the different facets of the show. I'll just tell you why they finally decided not to do it. They looked at it and they said, well, what do we need another late night show for? We've got Cavett and Breslin.
There's your answer. When you've got those guys, you don't need anybody else.
That's right.
How about the acting career?
Please. I am not an actor. Every time I have decided to allow myself to be photographed in some kind of a role, there has been the whim of one of my offspring involved. In the case of Miami Vice, they offered this role to me as a cocaine dealer. I mean, if you're in rock and roll and they want you on that show, that's all you get to be, is a cocaine dealer. And usually they kill you at the end of the show. So I turned it down, but at the time that the offer came in, my son Amit was 10 years old, and it was his favorite television show, and he was dismayed that he wasn't going to be able to see his very own dad on there being a cocaine dealer. So I said, okay, I'll do it, so long as you don't kill me at the end of the show. And so I did it, and I've never even seen the show. When the thing was running, when it was aired, I was in New York City, and I went to see Pierre Boulez conducting the New York Philharmonic instead. So to this day, I still don't know how I look as a cocaine dealer.
Oh, something in your book that you sort of touched on but sort of just hinted at. You said that something about there are no ghosts in that part of the house. So does that mean that there are ghosts in?
Well, from time to time, the kids have told me they've seen strange things in the house. But then again, you know how children are.
And the other one you had where that was opposite Houdini's place.
The log cabin.
Yeah, I heard that story as well. It's like one of the first things I ever heard when I came here.
What about the tunnel that goes underneath the street?
Yeah.
Well, maybe it's true.
It was like I was driving up and somebody said, you know, at Houdini's house there's a tunnel under there.
Mm.
I think literally it's about the first thing I was ever told about LA.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure there are more tunnels up here.
Yeah.
Because, well, that's really not a joke, because there are military installations, like rocket things, tucked away in the hills up here. And there is one big underground military intelligence installation up in Laurel Canyon that eventually went up for sale with like 16 car underground garage, concrete bunkers and all this stuff. So who knows what's really up here?
Jeez. And talking about that, was it incredible to find out that the Blacklist was not where you might expect it?
Yeah, once upon a time, no. You know, that for anybody who ever wondered whether or not Americans were serious about freedom of speech, or whether they'd really go to the wall like the Chinese are ready to do right now, whether we would really support free speech all the way, look at the kind of forces you're up against. I saw a piece of paper or a stack of papers dating from the 70s from the Department of Defense, and contained in this, as if it were a matter of national security, was a blacklist of songs that should not be played on the radio because they were a matter of national security. And one of them was Puff the Magic Dragon. Imagine this. I see it's got to be like Dr. Strangelove, a guy, you know, with his arm jumping up and funny accent. Puff the Magic Dragon, we cannot let them hear this song.
That's probably where Peter Sellers probably is, actually.
Yeah.
Can you remember what else was on there?
I think there was about 28 tunes on there. I think one of them was 8 Miles High.
Oh, well, obviously it's a very dangerous song.
Sure. And the intonation, too, the 12-string guitar and everything.
Oh, come on, yes. Mustn't anybody hear that. God. On about intonations, you had also said somewhere that when it came to writing music, you don't sort of sit down with pen and paper anymore, that everything's done in the head.
Well, actually, everything's done on the computer. I have a word processor-like device that will allow me to organize musical material by pushing a few buttons. And it's a faster way to do the same sort of thing that you would be doing with a pencil on a piece of paper.
When you compose or you're thinking of something, are you someone who just likes to find one thing to work on and compose, or you sort of compose orchestrally? Like, do you hear different parts when you...
I can hear the whole thing finished. You know, I can hear the thing finished before I start on it. And then it's just a matter of doing all the drudgery to effectuate the completion of the piece. And then some things, you know, you hear a little piece of it in your head, and then you build the stuff around it. I can put things together a lot of different ways. It just depends on how the idea appears and whether or not you like the idea well enough to put in the elbow grease to finish the thing off.
Do you ever worry that maybe you won't, if you like, get to the composition of from start to finish on the composition before it goes out of your head? Or?
No. I mean, if I forget it, so what? No great loss. I got to hear it. Yeah. There it was. I heard it.
Mm-hmm. And if you don't remember...
There's actually been a lot of songs like that. I mean, things that I thought were really fabulous at the time I thought them up, and then I would go to sleep and I'd wake up and they'd be gone and never came back. But other ones where you get an idea and you start with it, and that leads to another thing, which leads to another thing, and before you know it, you got something really complicated and monstrosity. Thingfish was one of those.
And what happened in that process?
Well, it began with me thinking about this joke that Captain Beefheart used to make. About something called Huna hands. And the concept of Huna hands was what, like people dancing and their hands puffed up like balloons, and the, you know how people like to clap their hands, sort of, and it was just this absurd image of normal-sized body, oversized hands, and doing this. And I'd been thinking, just, you know, that whizzed through my head for a minute one day, and somewhere in the vicinity of that, I was working on the idea of forward, part of your track forward, part of your track backwards, because there were fundamentalist elements in the news at that time complaining about backwards masking. And so I'd been working on a couple of experimental pieces where the rhythm track is solid and it's moving forward, and then you'd have all of the vocals backwards. One of those cuts was a song called Yahojna, which is on the Them or Us album. So once I had done that, I started thinking about what other lyrics would sound like backwards on a track, and I decided to take this tape of a song called No Not Now and play just the vocals backwards, and the result was Wonton On. So I started working on Wonton On just to do kind of like a sequel to Yahojna, and while I'm working on it, as I heard the result of putting these backwards vocals on top of a forwards track, I could see these Huna hands appearing, these big puffy hands, and people doing this to this. And then I started in my imagination, like, well, I see their hands, but what are they wearing? And then I just got this vision of people with lips, heads like a potato and lips like a duck and Aunt Jemima clothes and all this. And I started seeing these creatures in my mind, and then suddenly there was a story to go with them, and it just, every day I would write a little extra part on this story, and Ike Willis and Ray White would come over, and I would stay up all night, write 12 pages of script for a Broadway musical with songs in it, and then we would record it, and then the next day I would do some more, and this went on for a couple of months until we finally finished off a whole plot line Broadway show based on people with heads like a potato, lips like a duck, and puffy hands, and, you know, all this stuff. And it just started from this little nothingness.
I don't want to say rationalize, but do you ever wonder if you're going to, so, I don't say wake up tomorrow, but I suppose, and that's it? You've used up ideas, or you're just going to be dry? I mean, do you ever worry about...
No.
So there's never any thought of, like, well, maybe tonight that's it. I've just used up everything.
No, the fact of the matter is, I mean, if I were freeze-dried as of tomorrow morning, there's still enough material that is either near completion or stuff that's already finished that hasn't been released, and look around you. There's material here. There's plenty more where if I was completely numb, I could still continue to release for years just by putting together what's already in the process. But I, even if I were to dry up tomorrow, so what? It's all a joke anyway.
Where did Broadway come from, the hard way?
Oh, that's from watching televangelists. I mean, that's a direct response to Republican brainwashing and televangelist manipulation.
Simple as that, huh?
Yep. That was an easy one.
And do you think that we're hearing the dying strains of that wonderful group of ladies who insist that we should stick our albums, or do you think they're going to rear their ugly heads up again?
Well, you may not see their heads. You may see the heads of their husbands or some of their relatives, because they're already talking about enacting legislation. A couple of days ago in the music trades, they're talking about a study that was done to find out whether or not, in fact, it would be constitutional to clamp down on record lyrics. Some people just want to have censorship here. Some people want to turn the United States into Ayatollah land.
Does it ever make you want to pack up and go off somewhere else, or do you think this is about the best place that there is to suffer it, if you like?
Well, I think that there are other places in the world where they take life a little bit easier, and they don't take things so seriously and act as desperately as they do in the United States. But I believe that there's still hope for the United States to grow up. This country is 200 years old, approximately, and there are plenty of other places with a few thousand years under their belt, and maybe they've been through this crud before, and, you know, they did it, then they went against it, and they came back, or whatever. They've been through a few cycles. And the United States is kind of like this impudent little country with a lot of money. This week it's got a lot of money. Maybe next week could be different. might be speaking another language next week. Could be Spanish, could be Japanese, we're not sure. And we just have a lot to learn here, that's all. And if I can assist in the learning process and maybe learn a few things myself while I'm doing it, great. I'm not afraid that this country is going to collapse in on itself for at least another 20, 30 minutes.
Great.
The biggest danger facing the United States in the short term is people here are completely unaware of what 1992 is going to bring to Europe. The average American has no concept of what 92 and the United States of Europe could mean to the American economy. And if they knew, they'd be out doing some work.
Yeah.
But they just don't know.
Yeah. There's not many people covering that either. I think maybe NPR is about the only place that they get any information on that.
Yeah, but it's not just the information of the ongoing process. It's understanding the ramifications and all the economic implications of doing business with this European consumer manufacturing base of 330 million people who make things that work, who make things people want to buy, who also have economies that are good enough so that they can buy their own things.
Right.
And well, what are we doing here today? The major income source in the United States today, it seems, is divided between the process of making weapons for other people to blow themselves up, because we have far too much defense industry in this country, and the idea that instant profit is made in an instant on the stock market just because two big companies decided to sign a piece of paper. They didn't make anything, they moved paper, and suddenly more money went in somebody's pocket, and there's no product to show for it. This is a very stupid way to run an economy. And the more they do that, the greedier they get. They make these big companies, and then they sell off chunks and make some more money. People lose their jobs. There's no manufacturing. And because we don't manufacture it well, it will buy it from somebody else. There goes your trade balance and all the rest of that stuff. And nobody in a rock and roll audience wants to hear about this stuff. You know, they don't care about trade balance. What is that? That's the kind of thing that a person who's almost 50 years old talks about.
But rock and roll is part of the trade balance also.
That's true.
You know, a lot of people don't realize that. That's another big export that this country's got.
Yeah. Right now it does. But, I mean, what if the rock and roll from the United States finally gets as people realize how boring it actually is and they don't want to buy it anymore?
Yeah.
What are you going to do then, huh?
dig a hole, and that 30 minutes is going to be much closer than you think.
That's right.
Yeah. Well, I'll let you get a nap for the next 30 minutes before anything happens.
But yeah.
I thank you for the time so far.
Okay. Hello, I'm me. And the me, no, hello, I'm me, and my me is Frank Zappa. And hello, I'm me. And you're listening to the Westwood One Radio Network. Why are you doing this?